Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting. And if you're not using a web conferencing tool or a service that you're using now is, well, kind of clunky, use my first choice, GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is really easy to use. It turns a call into an instant online meeting in just one click. It's affordable, very secure, and it substantially reduces your meeting-related expenses. I got to tell you something. This is really neat because you can have voice over IP included, call in via the phone on your computer or just by using a phone. And you can try GoToMeeting for free for 30 days. But you must visit gotomeeting.com/podcast for that free trial. Again, that's gotomeeting.com/podcast for your free 30-day trial. Well, howdy there. How are you, folks? It's Andrew Horowitz, and we are going to have a great show today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 162. 162 episodes have gone by. I know a lot of you have written me recently and said that you have been here from the beginning. So, wow, thanks so much. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks so much for your time spending with me each and every week talking about things here with some great guests on the Disciplined Investor. And, of course, if you don't know, we also have the Winning Investor podcast that's available on the Quick and Dirty Tips Network. And that's really for, you know, beginners, people who don't have a lot of knowledge about the markets. We talk about PE ratios and stock charts, and we talk about fundamentals and understanding things. It's a five-minute quickie. I really encourage you to check it out on iTunes. And, of course, myself and John Dvorak talk each and every week on DH Unplugged, and that's kind of like a you're sitting with us at a bar on a friendly couch on a beach chair, and we're just chatting about all sorts of things financial. That's the place you want to check out each and every week as well, because it's just a real nice fireside chat talking about market, financial, economic, worldwide things. Sometimes we get a little off track, and sometimes John can get a little bit of curmudgeonly attitude, but this is a good thing. I really encourage you to listen to that as well. We have lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about the current markets that were. We're going to talk about the economics and things to look forward to in the near future. We're going to answer some questions that you have that you've sent me. We have to talk about, of course, the European situation that's going on. We're going to talk about some of what do you do in these kind of markets. And we're also going to have a guest that is going to talk about what happened when the markets failed. The flash crash that happened a couple of weeks back that had everybody spooked and is really creating a lot of controversy because the SEC right now still doesn't have any answers to speak about. So we'll talk about that, and we're going to kind of get into this, and I think that you're going to find it quite interesting, a lot of things that we're going to talk about. So let's see, where are we going to start? I think we need to start with, an obvious – I have all these papers. You're going to hear me rattling papers. We have a lot of things to talk about, but I think the obvious point is what happened last week. Let me give you a quick rundown of the week-to-date and year-to-date changes on some markets just to show you how quickly – investor sentiment can change. So the Dow Jones, the S&P, the NASDAQ were all down about 5%, 4.5%, 5% for the week. And year to date, when they were up like 9% at one point, they're down somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3% each of them. Brazil is down 13% year to date, 6% down for the week. And in Europe, which we had that great week last week, we saw a significant change to the overall sentiment and the concern over there as they didn't have any closure on their trillion-dollar bailout until Friday, which we'll talk about in a moment. And what we saw there was that the year-to-date change in, listen to this, in Great Britain and in the UK, 6%, France, 12% loss, Spain, 21% loss, Italy, 15%, Netherlands, 6.5%. The lone winner is Sweden with a slight gain for the year, and Switzerland is down about 5%. Overall, it was about a down 2 or 3% a week. In Asia as well, we had the same situation. I mean, the Nikkei, the Japanese markets, were down about 6.5%, and Hong Kong was down 4%, and Australia, which is, Australia made that really I'll say dumb, and there's no better way to describe it. They were just made a very dumb move by trying to put a super tax on the miners. Even though they need to collect taxes from somewhere, it's just going to cause them all sorts of problems. They're talking about their core industry and really pushing out those that are really doing a lot of business in that area, trying to redistribute it to their citizens. And I understand what they're trying to do. The problem is that when we look at Australia, we look at that as a core commodity-based country, and that's what they export, and they're mucking it up. That's what I got to tell you. Their markets are actually down year-to-date in Australia, about 11%, 22% in China, clearly in a bear market. So very few markets right now are not in either a correction and a couple of bear markets out there. So that's what's kind of going on, and you know, it was a very volatile week, and we also saw a lot of volume come into the markets, and that is one of the things that we've talked about, that do we pay attention to that, or don't we? Well, I think we do, excluding Friday's option expiration this week. But, you know, we look at the markets, and you have to notice that, you know, where is the buyers and sellers coming from? And if there's a lot of selling going on, and it's a lot of volume involved in it, or vice versa, buying and volume, well, we have to pay attention to that. We have to look at that. So, you know, we did see a lot of volume come in, and we realized that a lot of people were dumping. A lot of fear trading going on. I think this is, we really do see this right now, until further discussed in a different manner. This is a correction in a bull market trend. Does that make sense? It's a pullback, maybe more healthy and more robust than we would like it to be, but it is a pullback in a generally bull market trend or an uptrend. And under those circumstances, you have to be very careful. You have to wait for the next uptrend signal to really get all in, so to speak. And right now, you should be hedging and doing the things that we've always talked about. We came into the week in our portfolios with about a 40% net long exposure, dropped it down to about 25% Wednesday and Thursday, and then increased it to about a 50%, 51% long exposure on Thursday at the close, or very close to the close, and we're able to capture a lot of the market movement the next day. And then we're actually, you know, going to consider where we go from here, whether it was a healthy bounce, a quick relief rally, or if it's something that is going to continue due to the fact that we have a little bit more closure going on with the financial bill being at least passed through Senate. And on top of that, the German upper and lower house of parliament agreeing to their contribution, loan or gift or whatever we're going to call it, into the bailout for Europe. Now, listen, there is clearly problems. I mean, Spain did approve their austerity plan. Greece approved their austerity plan. At least the government did. The people haven't. They're pissed. But, you know, when you look at the European situation, it's going to be a combination of not only policy, but it's going to have to be severe restraint right now. And that's what's concerning most of the world. How much of that's going to flow into other places? Is it going to slow down the spending in Europe? Well, it has to. And how much of that is going to be reflected in companies in the U.S. and China, in South America and Latin America, and all over the world? You know, what does that really mean? That's where the big unknown is right now. And you know, you have a lot of other things happening that really kind of converged last week. We had the uncertainty about Germany passing the bill. We had, of course, a negative connotation when it comes to the initial claims. We're talking about a 477,000 print when we're all looking for about 440 or less. That really wasn't too exciting. North Korea is now being accused of shooting a torpedo into the South Korean boat that sunk. We had that oil slick that was estimated 5,000 barrels per day. That could be as much as 10 times that amount. And they're being accused of not fraud, but holding back information, BP is, and not providing transparency and good information otherwise. But, you know, and then we see a lot of other things. Like, for example, the biggest thing that was really the biggest problem last week was the surprise. Very big surprise, by the way. I mean, this was Tuesday, Wednesday. Germany came in and said, you know, no more are you going to be allowed to short the 10 largest banks. And they had some other rules that said, okay, also certain CDS exposures and certain ways of hedging and not going to be allowed anymore, no naked short selling, blah, blah, blah. Okay, but it was out of the blue, and it was individually done. In other words, it was a standalone process, and reported recently was that Germany didn't tell anybody else. In other words, they did it on their own accord without anybody else. So that was a big problem. So you put these all together, and there's a few other things we could talk about. You know, Dell's earnings stunk, and a couple of the retailers did really well, a couple of them questionable. And it's been a very difficult time because confusion is high. And as we talk about it many times, when confusion is high, markets get really pissed off. What do you do in that kind of circumstance? Well, there's some people that like to bottom fish. And as a matter of fact, we have a question that came in about this, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Some people like to say, you know, we'll wait for the upturn. We'll wait till we see some significant move. We can like a lot of stocks, but let's hedge out some of the risk. That's us over here. You know, we may like this core grouping, but we're not going to hold on to them for dear life. We'll pare back a little bit and then pare back in, depending on market conditions, if things are right. We'll increase if we see the trend changing for an individual position or for a for a market itself, because a lot of times you can have a great stock and the markets are terrible and it doesn't matter. The stock still goes down. We know this. But what don't you do? You don't rush into anything. There's plenty of time to get in. A couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I said, get in the game. Now, that didn't mean invest and all that. That means get involved. Now, if anybody, a couple of emails came in and said, Andrew, you talked about getting in the game. Are you saying that we should be buying? No. You could be shorting. You could be buying. You could be doing a lot of things. But get in the game. That doesn't mean throw your money out there and be stupid about it and be reckless about it and just do it, you know, because it looks like a good time to do it. But get in the game. Put on your kind of game hat, your clothes, your uniform. You're studying the stocks. You're getting ready to and buy on the right time versus just committing to not being in the game. There's a big difference. There's a very big difference. And when I say getting in the game, I mean getting in the process. Okay? So let's take a couple of questions here, and I want to talk to you afterwards about some of the economic numbers that are coming up next week, and a really, I thought an amazing report that we just pulled off and took a look at, and then recreated, actually. I'll put this on the website, about steel production in the world. I think this is amazing. But let me just get to a couple of questions first that came in. All right, so where are we going to go first? All right, let's go to this one. And this, let's see, it says here, I don't want to mention his name here because he asked me not to mention his name, but it says, the major oil companies long ago collaborated to form an in-house teams to do certain tasks in the event of an oil spill. The teams have been trained and are ready to go into action. The idea is that all oil companies at their own expense would come to the rescue of the oil company with the spill. But BP has never called the other oil companies into action. We had a guest who was employed by Chevron over Saturday night, and she's a team leader and has been expected to be called up to work on the oil spill for the last 2 weeks. But BP has not asked the other oil companies to participate in the cleanup. Now, I'm just taking this as face value from someone, a listener, who has been listening to us for a long time. And that's kind of, that does go along right with what the government is saying, that there's been very little transparency and there's been very little openness and cooperation and any kind of cross, whether it's governmental or cross company cooperation that has been brought in by BP. And that's a real concern. This question comes in, another one comes in. This one was, I thought, really interesting, from Dan. He says, Andrew, I'm a novice investor trader. I'm going to have 3 years in fall investing in the stock market. Come a long way considering the small, meager money I started with, only to get crushed in 08 and do extremely well in 09. That being said, what the heck is going on with this market? I heard your podcast and McClellan hit it right on the money. I'm getting smashed again and getting margin calls. Is it time to unload and sit on the sidelines? What can you tell me about investing with margin? I see the market tanking and I figure it's a good time to buy, so I use my margin capital only to see the stock go lower. I'm sure you know what I mean. Then one sells and shoots higher. Appreciate your wisdom, friend, Dan. You know, Dan, the first thing about margin investing is, let me give you three words. Don't do it. Margin investing, when you have to start worrying about margin calls and making decisions on selling something, if it's going down to meet that call, is just a really bad idea. There's other ways to leverage up so you don't have to worry so much about that. For example, you can use options, okay? Or if you don't want to be so greedy because margin really is, you know, trying to get a little bit too much money on something, and when it goes against you, it hurts doubly as bad. The problem is that you should probably start thinking about really not utilizing a margin balance to invest. Do it the old-fashioned way. When you're investing, core investing, quality stocks that meet the criteria that you're trying to establish, And from there, what you can do is you can invest in them without the margin. So in other words, 100% invested, if that's what you choose to do. But utilizing the margin the way you're doing it, which sounds like you're doing it in a way that you're getting margin calls already, and frankly, we haven't even seen a significant market decline, and you're getting margin calls? That's a big problem. You should have probably thought of some important levels in order to get out of those positions and made a commitment prior to investing. What you're probably doing is you're doing a lot of buying and hoping. You're not doing a buying and investing. You're not buying the position with a target on the upside and the target on the downside. If you were, you wouldn't be getting these margin calls, right? So the first thing is don't use margin. That's just a stupid way to do things. That's what got us all in trouble when it comes to the housing crisis and the meltdown in the markets recently. So I'm not calling you stupid, Dan. I'm just telling you, I don't think that's a great idea. You did great because you leveraged it up in 2009. But you know what? You did great because 2009 was a good year. Was it really the fact that you did your research and investigated the positions that were to be used? Or was it just a little bit of luck? Because if right now you're getting killed and in 2008 you got killed, it tells me you're just riding the markets up and down. You're not doing a lot of research. You're just picking out, you know, things that are moving with those markets and then just leveraging it. I just don't see that as a good way of doing things. If you want to write me, anybody out there, and you want to see what's going on and see about maybe getting your question answered on the podcast, all you do is write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Couple more things I want to talk to you about, and then we'll bring on our guest. I want to talk about the McClellan Oscillator. I wrote a piece this week. I talked to Tom a few times after last week's discussion, and I saw that the McClellan Oscillator was actually in the like below negative 400, 420, and I never saw that before. This was on Thursday. I called him up and said, Tom, what does that mean? He said, well, it means it's the lowest it's been in history, and he wrote a piece on it the next day. I put that on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, about maybe this is a turning point, at least a bottoming process right now in the markets. And I want you to take a look at that. I think it's an important read and something that you really should take a look at. So check out The Disciplined Investor. I'll try to put a link on that as well. I also want to talk to you a little bit about the idea of gold. A lot of people are asking, hey, Andrew, what are you doing with gold? We had gold. We had about a 5% position across the board in many of our portfolios. We cut that back in some portfolios to zero and about 2% or less earlier in the week in others. We also sold all of our silver off. We think that the correlation between the gold and the dollar and the euro and the other thing are just not playing anymore. That doesn't mean gold can't go up. We just think that there's a little bit of a drawdown going to happen right now, and the euphoria of investing in gold is going to be quite lower than it was. And the fact that we have this, at least this $1 trillion backstop in place when it comes to Europe is going to be a big help and stop many of the scare tactics about a default. That's where the problem was, not the level of where the euro was. All right, another thing, two more things. We'll talk about some economics coming up. I want to talk to you about this, though. We looked at a table that showed us the crude steel production around the world. And if you were to think about, like, who creates and produces the most steel, crude steel production around the world, what would you think? Who would it be? What country? I mean, you would think that the United States probably has a good amount. Maybe Canada. Maybe China and Japan. Well, let me tell you this number. Maybe even Brazil. In April 2010, China had a 45% share. 45% share of the crude steel production of the entire world. Next was Japan with 7.5%. I mean, look at that. United States was third with 5.5%, Russia 4%, India 4%, South Korea 3%, Germany, Taiwan, Ukraine about 2s. Brazil was only 2. And then you go down to the 1s, Turkey, Italy, Spain, France, Mexico. I mean, I couldn't believe that there was such a vast... We knew that China had a big chunk of it, but I was so surprised to see that number increase over the last year to about 46%. It was a bit lower, but it's still just an amazing number. Where we've held steady in the United States, Japan has actually dropped a little bit. And again, China has picked up some of the slack from them. But other than that, it's really been dropping off otherwise. And if you include Taiwan in there, you have to include another 2.5%. So that whole Chinese, you know, China region. All right, and finally, before we get to the guest, we're going to talk about some of the things that are coming up next week. We saw some things this week that were a bit concerning. I mentioned just a moment ago in economics, the 477,000 print. We saw the 9.9% unemployment. Empire State survey came in. Manufacturing was a little bit weak, although Philly was a bit stronger. We have Richmond Manufacturing next week. We have some consumer confidence coming out early in the week. The Case-Shiller numbers on Tuesday. So that's good. That's good stuff because I think they'll show up well. We have GDP on a quarter-over-quarter basis on an annualized coming up Wednesday, along with personal consumption. That's something we want to watch. Personal consumption is going to show us how much appetite there is out there for the consumer. We saw Walmart and Target come in with decent numbers. Walmart better than Target. Some of the retailers come in with some really good numbers last week as well. A couple of them off, Hot Topic and a few others. But those are more specialty stores. And when you look at the numbers that we're going to see next week, nothing that is really, you know, amazingly important in the beginning of the week. The Case-Shiller number for housing is important. Existing home sales important. But in the middle of the week, you got to watch because we're going to see these initial claims again, personal income, personal spending. And, you know, these are numbers that we want to pay attention to see if we are actually slowing down right now or, in fact, if this is a continuation of an economic recovery that will continue in light of all the things that are going on. I think that the consumer confidence number that we'll see on Friday, the University of Michigan consumer confidence number, will be very telling. We're looking for about a 73, which is where it's been for a while, and no significant tail off. We're actually looking for a consumer confidence from another style of computation on Tuesday. And that's looking at a 58 versus 57. I think we may hit there, but we need to be careful to watch that. Combine that with the retail numbers and the personal consumption. So anyway, we'll be right back. We're going to talk about what's going on with the flash crash, and if that infers whether it's flash trading or not. And I think you'll be very interested to hear from our next guest. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, so I promised you right before we broke a great guest, and we're going to talk about things like the flash crash and a few other things. And who would I turn to for a question like that? Who would I get that I would really think had the answers? Well, you know him as Tyler Durham, or better so, as Zero Hedge, a good friend of mine and someone we've had on the show several times before. And we want to thank you for joining us today, buddy boy. How are you?
I'm good, Andrew. Thank you.
So, flash crash theories. We got Fat Finger. We got discussion about Waddle and Reed doing a 75,000 sell on the Spooz Minis. We have a cascade effect with sell stops. We have a slow trade in New York Stock Exchange, fast trade everybody else. SEC doesn't know what's going on, which, by the way, in parens, no kidding, right? They never seem to. So what do we take away from this? What's the story on this flash crash from a couple of weeks back?
Well, I mean, it's. I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that nobody really has any idea what's happening. I'm pretty convinced that the SEC and the industry lobby is very well aware of what's happening. The problem is for them to take proactive steps to fix it would require a massive market overhaul, or market structure overhaul, rather, which would hit the P&Ls of a whole host of players, market players. And it would eliminate billions and billions of dollars in revenue for a whole slew of firms, which is obviously the primary reason why neither the SEC nor any of the other regulators has any intention on moving either fast or moving proactively on this topic. If you will harken back to our initial interview, which we had, I believe it was in March or April of last year, mm-hmm. I'm pretty convinced, or I recall that the conclusion that liquidity could dry up overnight or in a matter of seconds is exactly what I concluded back then. So I think, you know, some people definitely had a clue of what might be happening as a result of all these recent developments in market structure, which, you know, for lack of a better word, one can say is basically the cannibalization of liquidity by the so-called high-frequency trading brigade. And really what happens there in a nutshell is that liquidity, as long as things are fine, is ample and sufficient, especially for the penny stock names that over the past year or so have, you know, been the dominant volume provider in pretty much all capital markets on the equity side. I envision here, obviously, the bankrupt names such as Citi, such as the Fannies and the Freddies, the CIT pre-bankruptcy, et cetera. Now, you know, when things turn violent, literally in this case, it's obviously on May 6th, one of the primary catalysts for the liquidity evaporation was obviously the live pictures of, you know, the storming of the Greek parliament. We had a period, obviously, between 2:40 p.m. and 3 o'clock, roughly, when there was no liquidity. And, again, the primary reason for this, really, was that basically everybody decided to go from, you know, one side of the boat to the other. And it was a classical bidless situation where the NYSE, I think their very disingenuous excuse has been, you know, we were replenishing our liquidity replenishment points or some other, you know, garbled jargon that makes no sense. But in essence, there were no buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the SEC is trying to explain right now. You know, how can you go in a market that is allegedly stable and efficient, literally in a span of minutes, from a fair and balanced market to one in which there's only sellers? And, you know, for a proper explanation of how this can happen, you have to really, again, look literally at the fundamentals of the market structure, which, again, is based on computers really trading purely with each other. The human element has disappeared. There are no specialists anymore in the market. The traditional market structure that worked for, you know, many, many decades is no longer the fact. And we are simply just waiting for another episode like this to happen, whether it's tomorrow, whether it's in 1 week, as long as there is really no reform in market structure. You know, one interesting point that bears bringing out here is the fact that I believe after the fall of Lehman, the New York Stock Exchange, which right now is saying, you know, it really wasn't our fault, they created this thing called the Supplementary Liquidity Provider Program, which I think we also touched upon last time we spoke. And for the longest time, it was really just Goldman Sachs, who was the so-called primary, you know, SOP provider. Gradually, they were joined by another firm, Getco. But still, this is a program that has been very, very under the radar. Nobody really knows much about it, except that this was a fail-safe backstop program in case we have an episode exactly like the one we had on May 6th. So something happened, and even the SOP program, you know, failed to deliver to the primary reason for its very own existence. So in the meantime, we had Goldman basically pickpocketing, you know, pennies on the dollar for millions and millions of trades on a daily basis up until the moment that it was required to actually step in and help restore liquidity. And when that moment was required, they did not step in. So maybe the SEC and the New York Stock Exchange can explain what exactly was the purpose of the SOP program, why Goldman was not where it was supposed to be, where was Getco, the number one high-frequency trader in the world, et cetera. I mean, these are very critical questions that nobody has touched upon.
So let me ask you this. So how about this as a, you know, kind of a sidebar discussion, that if you want the guys to step in to take over where liquidity has failed, and at the same time allowing them to do it, you know, giving them the bone to, okay, play their high-frequency trading game and do what they do, don't slap a fraud action against them, and don't try to eliminate high-frequency trading, because by doing so pisses them off to a point that, you know what, they may step back when they're most needed.
Well, you know, that's obviously one aspect of, you know, kind of the game theory or approach to things. I think really what needs to happen is gradually the market really needs to get back to a structure which is, you know, at least the form of a hybrid to what we had at least in the, you know, 90s and early 2000s. What we've seen over the past decade has been a massive collapse in margins on flow trading, basically, which has been due to the increased computerization, increased sophistication of markets,
right,
which has pushed out all the human players.
Right.
And the only entities and the only businesses who make money from trading at this point really are the business models that are geared to actually make some sort of profit when bid-ask spreads are ridiculously low. Now, the trade-off, really, I mean, Andrew, the bottom line is we're having a trade-off where trading costs are very low. They're probably now lower than they've ever been in the history of capital markets.
I agree.
However, again, the trade-off to that is that we have a very, very precarious and unbalanced liquidity situation. So we can be trading literally for any given trade can occur at no price or no incremental cost and, you know, for going forward. However, we could always end up with a situation where liquidity is simply disappeared just like
right,
that.
Right.
And that's really what the question that the regulators have to ask themselves. Is it worth having a market where there is no marginal, you know, cost or barrier to entry into the market itself by retail players, by institutional players, only to see liquidity disappear and, you know, years, months, days of capital price appreciation disappearing as well, just because it was so easy for everybody to enter this market?
Right.
That's really, in my opinion, the number one question that has to be addressed.
Yeah. And, you know, I was reading a story this week, last week, and there was some discussion that, you know, to get rid of the high-frequency trading and to get rid of all these kind of problems, we need to cut the spreads maybe to a half a cent. And I said to myself as I was reading that, wait a minute, so now we're going to cut the risk even less for the high-frequency traders? Because essentially, if you have no risk on the bid-ask side of things, in between those, they have no risk. In other words, so if they go into a position, they can get right out of the position immediately. It would seem logical to me, and tell me if I'm wrong about this and thinking about this backwards, that you want to increase the spreads maybe back to the fractional system.
Well, yes and no. Keep in mind that, again, the biggest revenue stream really for HFT guys, at least the portion of high-frequency trading that relies on liquidity provisioning, which, again, if you read advanced trading and some of these industry rags, that's really what they all do. For them, you know, the decreasing bid-ask spread is becoming, you know, a very big issue, obviously, for profit margins. So if you get to a point where, you know, currently the way the market is set up is it makes no sense for, you know, specialists to really participate because obviously they're going to be constantly outmaneuvered by the computer system. So one of the proposals that I have floated on Zero Hedge and elsewhere has been to reinstitute some sort of transaction tax, not so much to punish, you know, retail traders or whatever, but to drive out some of the marginal players in the high-frequency realm. And in doing so, to bring back the human element of trading, because if you throw out enough high-frequency guys, it will once again become profitable for specialists and for DMMs to get in and to actually provide a human element of liquidity provisioning as opposed to this unemotional system where, you know, everybody touts lack of emotion is phenomenal, but it also leads to, you know, accentuated trading at 1 cent.
But when you go to a transaction tax, you'd have to split it off and do something like what commodities traders do when they look at the professional / non-professional. I mean, you're not suggesting that we have a transaction tax on non-professionals, are you? Or non, maybe even high-frequency, high-volume trading?
No, I think I'm definitely against making trading prohibitive for retail players. I mean, if people want to participate in this casino, more power to them. But I definitely think that what the SEC has done, assuming they're genuine about it, which over the past several months they've floated a proposal to tag high-frequency traders. And one way to bring some sort of stability to the market is to incrementally tax, you know, these high-frequency traders to the point where it almost becomes prohibitive for those who really do not really do any liquidity provisioning as they profess to be doing, and to weed out some of the parasitic players, so to say. And the fewer of these, you know, pure play parasites you have floating around, again, only at that point will it once again become profitable for the non-HFT players to come back to, you know, put a toe back into the market.
Right. Now, when you look at the markets around the world, I'm thinking if memory serves me correctly, the New York Stock Exchange with its hybrid approach right now, still having some level of human interaction in the floor, et cetera, is one of the last remaining traditional auction-based exchanges in the world. Everything else is electronic.
Correct.
I mean, I remember I was somewhere a few years back, and I said, oh, I'd love to stop by the stock exchange. And I wasn't thinking. I was just, you know, I don't know, was it Spain or I was somewhere. And I asked somebody, they said, sir, we don't have a stock exchange. I said, what do you mean you don't have a stock exchange? Well, everything's electronic here. I think, oh, yeah, that's a good point that you make there, you know. And really, the NYSE is the only one. And it's interesting because, you know, those are the ones that I agree with you that they can actually have some override potential Because if we're dealing with just machines, I've always said, and I've written many articles about this, you know, we're in a world of the rise of the machines, kind of like the, you know, the Terminator movie. And the problem is when machines go awry, like they did, or at least something happened with regard to the technology on May 6th. And you take, by the way, you take that a little further. I've always talked about the technology advances over the last decade have caused the high unemployment that we have now. If you take that to its fullest extent. But nonetheless, so do you think we're going to have a resolution by a government agency telling us what happened and to try to pacify the situation other than saying no short selling or something of that nature, crazy like that?
Well, deconstructing your question, I think, one step at a time. I think you're absolutely correct. I think over the past decade, we've seen an explosion in, you know, computerized exchanges. NYSE Arca, as you point out, is in a fight, you know, to the death at this point between itself and, you know, the fully computerized and NASDAQ, the bats of the world. And, you know, another thing that we've seen over the past, you know, several years has been this explosion in dark liquidity, the so-called dark pools, which are basically investment bank developed internal exchanges that are specifically, you know, allowed for only clients of banks and according to Reg ATS, which is another form of regulation, only the bank can decide which of its clients is allowed to get on board of a specific black pool. So you have all of these different venues where accounts can basically provide liquidity to each other, and it is making the NYSEs of the world essentially obsolete. So it's a huge evolutionary tug of war, and Duncan Niederauer is in a very tough spot, and I kind of feel bad for him, but he has some pretty good political connections, I think, with some of the traditional politicians who've had some interest in market regulation, et cetera. So I believe that there definitely will be some political interplay over the next year, which will try to make you know, exchanges such as the New York Stock Exchange, which still do have a human element, become a slightly more dominant factor. And I think there definitely will be an outcome from this flash crash, which will make the life for the HFTs, the parasitic HFTs, prohibitive. You know, what form this regulation is going to have, I have no clue at this point, yeah. Unfortunately. But I do think that, I mean, that's really the right thing to do, not only for the country, not only for, you know, from a purely capitalist standpoint, the exchanges that are not fully computerized, but that's, in my opinion, probably the only way that we will avoid a full-blown May 6th, type of scenario once again.
Yep.
Although, unfortunately, we are at the point where computerized trading is massive. It's probably 70-80%, maybe, if not more. So, you know, in the long run, I don't know what the right approach really is, but I have the sense that we are looking increasingly at a much, much more unstable and, you know, potentially liquid market when things happen like they did on May 6th.
Yep, I hear you. Let's switch over to something. I want to talk to you, but there's a lot of things going on. The new financial bill or whatever that is that's going on, yet it doesn't really touch on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Barney Frank talking on the, I think it was on Bloomberg or CNBC last week, talking about how he did not want, and back in 2005 was not in favor of expanding housing. He was talking about renting and housing wasn't a good idea, blah, blah, which we know is garbage. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of records going back showing he was very much, and if not one of the catalysts, to making sure that housing was given to everybody, you know, and that's what happened with Fannie and Freddie. I want to, though, talk about, we could talk about that, and then, or maybe you can take a choice. The other thing I want to talk about is this currency situation. I just threw a lot at you, but I want to ask you this question first. Uh-huh. So we see this situation going on in Europe. Now, Europe has always been a concern of mine, even though there's some good areas in there. Germany has been doing well productive-wise, and they have some problems with some debt. Not as bad as some of the others, of course, that lied on their way in. We know who those players are. But at the same time, you know, it was getting to a point over a month and a half, 2 months ago, that there was real concern about nobody was going to be buying treasuries for a while, that the U.S. was getting in over their head on debt. We saw that treasury rates started rising. We saw that at one point there was a report that came out that showed the tick trades were, the tick inflows, actually China was no longer sitting as number one, but they changed that data after, if you saw that, to China was still number one and still buying, everybody's still buying, but yet at not the same levels. Well, here's something interesting. Create and accelerate the credit crisis to maybe take down the euro and create a problem, creating a flock to safety. this is maybe far-fetched, pushing money back into the dollar, therefore pushing down treasuries, pushing money into treasuries. The euro goes down for a little while. They come back with a backstop. Yet at the same time, euro is down. It creates a lot of benefit for European exporters, etc. But at the same time, everybody kind of eventually wins by creating this very momentary and potentially win-win for the treasury market, for bringing in tons of money into the treasuries, and at the same time, you know, eventually mopping this up, hopefully. Far-fetched?
No, I mean, what you've described is exactly the kind of rinse, you know, repeat theory that a lot of people have noted in capital markets over the many, over the past, you know, decade. Anytime you need to reinstitute interest in treasuries, and keep in mind, we were at a point where the 10-year was trading at 4%, I believe, a little under 2 months ago. Yesterday, it hit just under 3%, so that's a huge move.
Huge move.
In the span of a month.
That's actually remarkable. Wouldn't you agree?
No, absolutely. And actually, that touches upon another issue, which is the massive amount of treasury curve positions put on by hedge funds and by investment banks out there, which actually the two stands as you know, people look at the steepness of the treasury curve has gone from a record of 290 roughly to 230, 240 in the span of a couple of days. If you look at the curve, I actually posted in Zero Hedge, it's a ridiculously fast move.
Mm-hmm.
And there are millions and millions of extremely levered positions out there that have gotten annihilated on this move as a function of the leverage associated with a lot of these positions. So a lot of the movement in some of the risk-free assets, such as gold, has had to do with precisely with covering short positions, or rather, you know, out-of-the-money positions that have gotten margin called, not so much in equities, but specifically in the Treasury curve department. So it is a huge move, but going back to your original question, you're absolutely correct that somebody with a conspiratorial bent can easily say that anytime there is waning interest in treasuries, the best thing to do is to stage a crash, whether it's an equity crash, a sovereign crash, etc. I don't necessarily think that that's really the entire explanation. I mean, ultimately, if you look at Europe, the entire continent was basically freeloading on extremely low interest for the longest time. And what we had happen over the past 4 or 5 months is that, you know, as people started digging into the financials of Greece, of Portugal, of Italy, of Spain, they uncovered just how ugly the truth really is. And the other problem is that, as Jim Rickards points out in a couple of his recent interviews, once you have the investment banks deciding to punish the sovereigns, nobody really knows where the so-called punishment will end, because when you're dealing with CDS, you can create CDS out of thin air, you can create billions, you can create trillions in CDS. And as you very well know, when you go from, you know, a bullish to a bearish mentality or bias, everybody can jump in on the bandwagon, and we can really go from 2-3% spreads on 10-year bonds, which is what Greece was in March, all the way to 20-30%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this created by CDS? Not really, but of course that's a very useful scapegoat for the politicians. However, it's a very big gamble when you're dealing with sovereign credit, because again, it's very easy for, you know, hedge fund XYZ to call up Goldman or Barclays and tell them, listen, I want to write 10 million, 100 million, 1 billion of CDS on Greece, on Italy, et cetera. And they can do that overnight or over the phone in the span of minutes. You don't have to put up any capital. You don't have to put up any margin of notable amount. And as a result of that, you can easily punish, or rather over-punish these countries.
Yeah, but then somebody's going to have to pay on the other side if it does default. So that doesn't mean, I mean, not everybody's just going to write this.
No, not everybody would write it unless, again, and this is where we go back to the whole Goldman Sachs situation where they were selling CDOs. All Goldman needs to do is to find the dumbest money out there to write insurance. You know, obviously we had AIG doing so in the housing crisis. And then we uncovered that the dumber money was moving east and east, further east, with Europeans writing the protection, then gradually Japan. So as people are becoming more and more intelligent here in the U.S., the dumbest money was moving to Europe and gradually to Asia. Who knows who Goldman might have sold the long risk end of the trade to? We don't know that. So that's one question that definitely is open to debate.
Yeah.
You know, who is on the hook for having written so many trillions in CDS and sovereign CDS? In other words, who is a sovereign AIG? And what would have happened if, this entity wasn't bailed out? And, you know, I have the gut feeling that really you would find out that it was more European banks. Now, if you recall, it was discovered that one of the biggest parties that had written CDS or bought CDS in Greece, rather, was a Greek entity. And the firms that were writing the CDS on Greece were European banks. So it's really very... close, catch 22,
right.
Where, if one of the countries blows up, and this is the whole so-called contagion effect, you would really see, all of Europe going down in flames, which, many people have speculated the bailout of Greece was really nothing more than a bailout of France, or French banks, rather. Now, of course, if France is downgraded, or France sovereign rating is downgraded, or if a French bank were to go down, then, America would be next.
Everybody's trying to step in and do it. This discussion reminds me of something. And that reminds me of the fact that I was reading some very interesting prospectuses probably about a year ago. And it was brought to me by clients, and they said, what do you think of this? And it was these very strange structured deals where you would get a certain amount of return, let's say 10% guaranteed, if the S&P went up this much during this one-year period. It's usually a one-year period they would do this for. And then if it went up higher than that, you would only get a certain amount lower. And if it went down, you wouldn't lose any money, right? And it struck me as this very strange thing that they would put this range in there. In other words, it had to be right at these numbers at this certain date. And I always said to myself, what would stop these companies that are selling these to try to take it down during that period if they sold a tremendous amount of these, not having, therefore, to pay any interest on the deal? Mm-hmm. I mean, have you seen these? They're ridiculous.
Oh, no, absolutely. Those were, kind of very famous type of transactions in 05 through 07, and they're actually making a renaissance yet again over the past 6 to 12 months. And Goldman and Morgan Stanley and actually even Deutsche Bank have been issuing quite a few of these. I don't think there's really much sinister to these. All these really are, in some ways, it's just exactly like the CDL deal, where obviously to every buyer there is a seller.
Yep.
All these are transactions which allow somebody to hedge an opposite type of transaction, whether it's on the long or the short side. An account has done their homework, looked at the math, and figured out that for a given equity, unhedged equity position to make sense, they need somebody, whether it's a Morgan Stanley or Goldman, to provide them with a synthetic transaction, which is really what CDLs were all about as well, in which they can hedge half a billion or a billion in equity risk. In the form of a big option, really,
put
or a call,
with
a strike such and such, with a duration such and such.
Right.
And, the banks, for lack of a better word, will provide this kind of transaction or this kind of product. And if they're stupid, they're going to keep the credit risk on their balance sheet. If they're smart, like Goldman, they're going to offload it to the dumber money. That's it.
Let me ask you this, and we'll close with this, because I need an explanation, because I'm having a lot of argument with people about this. And I don't obviously understand, because it seems very logical to me what I think about this, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Chinese revaluing the yuan to a free float system, a standard free float. I do not see, I just can't get it through my head, how this is beneficial to China. Yet, Geithner and everybody's going, Geithner and the world, this is a great thing. Now, I understand how it's beneficial for us. I get that. I see how it will help oil. I see how it will help materials. I see how it will help the trading partners. I see how, but I don't understand if China is still going through a process of rebuilding and all that, and even though they have this massive amount of surplus and they have just huge amounts of inventory of not only precious metals but materials, what do they care? And they're smart. They piggybacked us the whole way. Why would they revalue now?
I totally agree with that, and I think if you've read some of Albert Edwards' pieces from Société Générale, you will find exactly the same argument. Another thing to keep in mind is that in March, China recorded the first trade deficit since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
All currency revaluation or devaluation suggestions are basically it's a shorthand for whether or not a country has a positive or negative trade balance. So in other words, if a country is importing more than it's exporting, the currency has to, you know, move appropriately. Now, to say that China has to devalue by, or revalue the yuan rather, by 20% or 25%, which is what Chuck Schumer has been saying for many, many years, would have to assume implicitly that China is going to have a trade surplus in perpetuity,
right,
to the tune of, you know, 20%, 30% roughly.
Right.
That is changing as China is moving away from a export-driven economy to one in which it's, you know, accumulating resources, which in many ways is spurred by the fact that the U.S. dollar is no longer a safe haven and increasingly becoming less of a reserve currency. As China has been diversifying away from purely dollar exposure, whether it's in treasuries or however, they've been buying up commodities, they've been buying up gold, and, you know, in doing so, their trade balance has shifted. April was a bit of a surplus once again, but I have the feeling that increasingly China is going to become more of a, you know, trade deficit type of country, which renders all discussions about, you know, yuan undervaluation moot, because, you know, for that to be a viable strategy, China is going to keep, they're basically not going to go along with, you know, U.S. demands to revalue the yuan. And furthermore, keep in mind that there's also the geopolitical aspect. If China keeps getting pressured by the U.S. to do something, it's never going to do it. I mean, there's always this, you know, national pride issue as well. So the louder the U.S., you know, pushes on this issue, the more the staunchier China is going to defend its position. So,
but also, but Tyler, let me ask you, if they have this massive, massive amount of treasuries, right?
Yes.
They're going to instantly lose money if they revalue up 5%. They're going to lose that.
Well, yeah, that's another issue as well. And they have roughly $2.4 trillion. So, you know, a 20% revaluation would whack their exposure massively. You're right.
I don't understand how they're, you know, and the best is that Geithner was going to, there was this letter that was signed by, I don't know, 65 or 70 or 100 congressmen who said that, you know, they believe that China is a currency manipulator. And by the way, by us going there and telling them to change their currency and to do all this, obviously, just to let the folks in Washington know, that means we are currency manipulators, right? By trying to change the valuations of various currencies and by printing money and by bringing down the we are currency manipulators as well. Let's just get through that through their head that they don't understand. But by them doing so, they sent this letter. Geithner squashed the letter, and he was only going to release it after his visit, which I think is next week, to China. I guess he's holding it in his back pocket because there's still unknown, you know, even though everybody knows what the letter says, it's unknown to China, and they didn't want to put that out in the press and the media and all that, saying this is an official statement by the U.S. government. So I guess he's putting that in his back pocket as some ammunition, right?
Well, the Treasury was supposed to come out with an official statement on whether or not China is a currency manipulator, I believe, in early April, and they delayed it for, you know, a month or two, and that whole issue has kind of disappeared because at this point, obviously, it's a lose-lose type of game. If the U.S. now comes out and says, you know, it's not a currency manipulator, it will, you know, make all the guys who followed Schumer into this whole, you know, headlong rush, which is, as you pointed out, you know, a quarter of Congress look like idiots. On the other hand, if the U.S. does say that China is a manipulator, it'll only escalate the potential, you know, tariff escalation and trade wars, which many are saying is, you know, a potential second coming of Smoot Hawley. And, you know, with our economy being where it is, the last thing we need is basically the catalyst that, you know, really pushed the Great Depression into becoming the Great Depression.
I think that every country, even though we're a global economy, needs to kind of reset their program to more of a pro-growth rather than a, I don't even know what it's called right now. You know, they're looking to, because they've been so reckless with money. I mean, this is a pipe dream, but they've been so reckless with money, as we've discussed many a time. You know, and possibly some of it was necessary. No question about, you know, with all the downfall, there was a prop up needed. But they've been so reckless with their rulings, with their lacking of any kind of backbone, with the inability for them to do much to prop up this economy. And of course, now we're seeing there's a lot of job growth, but that's coming a lot for the next 4 months, I suspect, from census workers primarily, and the temporary, of course. But I think that, you know, the economy and the way things are going, companies are making better money, and that's good for companies. But the economy as a whole, as I see it, you know, we have a little bit of potential upward trend to go from here. But if these guys continue to be so ridiculous with their overhauls in such a fast manner, we still don't know what the effect of the healthcare is going to be. And already on top of our heads, we have a new financial regulation, which we don't know what that's going to do.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there should be a little intermezzo if we're using a dinner metaphor. You know, I mean, just take a little break. What's the need to get this all done? I mean, things need to be regulated.
Andrew, the problem with that, of course, is if you take a break, you know, the whole house of cards is going to crumble. You need to keep putting money into the system in some form, whether it's monetary intervention or fiscal policy intervention. Another, you know, you touched upon a good point that, you know, the U.S. is very angry at what China is doing when, in essence, they're doing exactly what we're doing. Obviously, the yuan is pegged to the dollar, so, you know, it's almost as if we have the same Federal Reserve between the two countries.
Right.
And on the other hand, they're doing exactly the same thing as we're doing in the fiscal arena. In other words, they, you know, their credit looseness is exactly what the U.S. was doing when the housing bubble was you know, surging. So I think for us to say that China's doing something wrong or incorrect is, you know, the utmost hypocrisy.
Right.
When all they're trying to do is basically to reflate their economy in very much the same way as we are.
Yep.
And, you know, keep in mind, for them, 11% GDP growth is something like, you know, 2.5%, 3% GDP growth for us, because if they have below 8% growth with their population growth, the economy basically, the whole Ponzi scheme falls apart.
Yeah.
So they need to keep reflating at a much higher pace than we do.
Right.
And they'll keep doing that until, you know, they have no other option.
And by the way, hat tip to China for doing a reflation job that is much better than we've ever done.
Well, you know, one can argue whether that is the case, because we don't really have a clear picture of what's really happening in, you know, underneath the surface in China.
True.
There have been reports that, you know, one of the main reasons why the Chinese market is in the bear, you know, it's 52-week lows now, the Shanghai Composite, is because people now finally realize that, you know, all those China skeptics ultimately have been right. Now, the question is whether China is going to have a hard or a soft landing. If houses really are plunging, you know, at ridiculous amounts, something like 50% month over month, or rather year over year, as some reports have stated, then it's pretty much game over for China. And some have actually said that the main reason why, you know, we are seeing this market collapse over the past, you know, couple of years, not so much Europe, but it's really China-driven.
Right.
And, I mean, just look at the commodity complex.
Yep.
You know, oil is down 20%, palladium, platinum, all the industrial metals are down even more. And, you know, why is that? Look at the Aussie dollar unwind. I mean, the biggest, you know, carry trade out there, which was, you know,
Aussie yen.
Yen.
Yep.
That has gotten, you know, that's imploded. I mean, the Aussie dollar is down, whatever, you know, 25-30%.
You know what? The Aussie situation, I got to tell you something. They started with a very fast rate increases time and time again. But I tell you something, the ultimate stupidity of that government to actually tax their miners and to put in not only tax, but this massive tax on their miners was probably the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Well, yes and no. I mean, at some point, you're going to see this happening all over the world. You know, Australia just took the first step. Fiscal policy, global fiscal policy is unsustainable, as evidenced by what you're seeing in Europe and what you will be seeing in the U.S. eventually. You know, 150% debt to GDP, 200% in the case of Japan. That's you know, that's ludicrous. That's, you know, a path to an apocalypse, sovereign apocalypse, or, you know, being less hyperbolic, you know, global debt repudiation would be inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And my sentiment is that you're going to see a lot more austerity, a lot more, you know, increasing tariffs, a lot more, you know, incremental taxation on, you know, the profitable industries than you have been seeing up until this point. And when it comes to situations like these, the last guy in is the loser. So the person who takes the first step is the one who wins.
Yeah.
At least on a relative basis. And, you know, in some ways, some can say Australia actually did the right thing by being the first one to do the right thing.
I hear you. So much going on around the world. My friend, I encourage everybody to visit ZeroHedge.com. I don't know if I opened with this, but I told you the day that the May 6th situation happened, the first thing that I did was go to your site. And do you know what happened? Do you know what happened, my friend?
No, what happened?
I couldn't get on. It was dead.
No, it was, we had probably several hundred times the maximum allowable traffic.
No, I know. I was very clear about that. I knew what happened. I knew what was going on, because if I was the first one going there, you know, if I was going there first, I'm sure a lot of other people, and I'm like, oh, man. You know, this is rough, because this would be a good time to see kind of the insight that you had there. And I knew there was a lot of traffic. Your site has been remarkably moving up the charts. Just an amazing run from some of the things that you've done over the last year. And I encourage everybody to check it out at ZeroHedge.com. There's always some interesting things there, some things that will twirl your ears. And I don't know where you get all your amazing insight and documents and information, but it is quite revealing oftentimes, and I would encourage everybody to check it out. Again, thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you, Andrew. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Always good to have Tyler with us, and I got to tell you, he is a, you know, maybe if you're listening to that discussion, you may get discouraged, and you may think, oh my gosh, where are we going? The world is ending. And very well, we may see a lot of things that are very concerning when it comes to, you know, not only these markets, but when it comes to the world, and is the world going to end? Is the financial system going to collapse? You know, if you take a step back just for a moment, I don't think it's exactly yet. I mean, Harry Dent said, hey, late summer into next year, possibly the next Great Depression. We've seen a lot of the naysayers. You know, Doug Kass came out this week saying he's extremely bullish. He's never seen profitability, you know, better. And at the same time, we're oversold. I think as we see it here, we're going to see a square root type of recovery in the U.S. economy. Now there's a monkey wrench thrown into it a bit, in that we have the situation with Europe that is causing, obviously, massive, massive problems in terms of the possibility of a slowdown in that region that will spread a bit. So therefore, GDP will be a little bit lower. Exporting and importing from the region will be questionable. Clearly, exports will be better if the euro is low, if it stays there, if it stays, you know, depressed. At the same time, imports could be a little bit slack and see a little bit less of an import situation. So where do you go? Well, there's some great stocks here that are very oversold in the U.S. You still have a lot of places around the world that have some wonderful companies that, even though there is this slowdown, will be making some great money. On the other hand, one of the things that we've recommended for our clients is to constantly hedge out risk where possible. You know, you don't want to be hedged entirely, because then you don't go anywhere. But right now, you know, we keep on vacillating between a 30% and a 50%, 75%, 25% exposure long. And, you know, that's helped us very much in this downtrend. Even though we're losing money in that position, of course, the fact is that still we see this as, right now until proven differently, that it is a pullback, a severe pullback, in a bullish trend. We still think that there is opportunity through the end of the summer, and that may be 3 or 4 months from now, and then we may see a further decline if the economy doesn't show any sustainability. But right now, there is a lot of concern. Just be careful with, you know, putting on any new significant amount of long exposure, even though it is tempting due to the fact that you see the markets are so oversold. But markets, as they've been oversold, can get overbought and stay that way for much longer than you think. So you have to be careful to look at the signs, look at the volume, look at the trend, look at all the things that go into place, and scale back on positions that aren't doing well, and then add back to them as they are going in your direction. You know, you may want to hold some because you think there is a great opportunity, even though they're pulling back a bit, until they really break to the point that, you know what, it doesn't look like there's support from there. At the same time, look at some of these ETFs and inverse ETFs to hedge out some of the risk. Well, we'll talk a lot about that and even more about some of this in our next show. We're going to talk about the idea of hedging your portfolio and how to do that next week. And also, I want to mention that, of course, if you want, check out the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, for more information on how we manage money for clients, some of the ideas we have for stocks. DH Unplugged and The Winning Investor are also two podcasts that you want to make sure to grab a hold of. Any questions or comments, write to me. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, have a safe week. Let's watch for that volatility. Watch that VIX to see what's happening. Watch the volume trends. And let's see if we can get on our feet right and you know, continue moving in a direction that's positive for your portfolio. I'll speak to you soon. Have a great week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.